Welcome, this is Lana, and you're listening to 314 on the Red Eyes Network. Joining me is a talented singer-songwriter, Nicole Jorgensen. In 2008, she found her way to Heidelberg, Germany, where she started her classical career as a soprano. We'll talk about her experience in Germany, which led to her realization of current globalist politics, causing her to return to North Dakota to start a family and live a simple life as her Norwegian ancestors. The story of Nicole Jorgensen up next. Nicole Jorgensen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so you have Norwegian roots. So tell us about your background, your Norwegian background.
Yeah, sure. My family is fourth generation farmers from Norway who emigrated to America in the beginning of the 20th century. We have roots hailing from Bergen, on the southwest corner of Norway, but our family actually originates from the Trondheim region and then further west into the island of Vikna.
It's beautiful up there.
Yeah, yes, it is. I was really fortunate to be able to meet my family a few years ago during some traveling that kind of helped reconnect the family after just about 100 years since we emigrated.
Oh, nice. So do you know the story of why they came to America?
Yeah. My great-grandfather, Axel, was looking for land, like I think a lot of people were during that that great immigration period. There was abundance of property in the Dakotas, and he came over with originally his two brothers and a sister. And the Homestead Act in North Dakota, in particular, gave people the opportunity to homestead and build on a quarter of land. And if they were able to manage to endure the hardships of the plains and the prairie, they were granted then that land. So he came back, he went back to Norway after a year and married my great-grandmother, and they came with their firstborn.
So Norwegian on both sides then?
Yeah.
Great.
Yes. Yep. Uh-huh. And it's actually the family of my great-grandmother, so it's a maternal line that's still well and living in Bergen, Norway.
So then is your husband also Norwegian? Because it seems like there's pockets like Minnesota and the Dakotas where different Scandinavian people went, and they've been able to stay pretty Scandinavian in some of those areas too.
Yeah. Yes, he is. He has also a little bit of German background, as do I. But mainly, both of us, I believe, are three quarters Norwegian. And in the city of Minot, North Dakota, there is an annual Norskustfest.
Nice.
Celebration every year. It's the largest Scandinavian festival outside of Scandinavia in the world.
Wow, I didn't know about that one.
Yeah.
And what do they do at the festival?
They celebrate our Norwegian heritage. They celebrate different types of foods. There's Viking reenactments. There's concerts. I actually sang with the Norwegian singer Sissel 1 year when she was visiting. And it's just a weekend celebration of our Scandinavian heritage, amazingly enough.
That's really cool. I love hearing that. So what is life like in the Dakotas? I know there's a lot of people who are eyeing it because there's so much land and it's pretty white up there. So what is life like in the Dakotas?
Well, you know, I have to say both my husband and I were incredibly fortunate to grow up in these tight-knit, high-trust, mainly white communities. I'd really say that we grew up in a bubble. I spent the last decade of my life overseas, living in abroad in large cities, and I never realized how fortunate we were until I came back. We all grew up, nobody locked their houses, nobody locked their car doors.
Luxury.
The guys would all go hunting in the mornings and they'd drive to school with shotguns in their back seats. Nobody cared or had to worry about it. It was a type of accountability and trust that I just took for granted. I thought that that's how everybody grew up.
So then, at what point did you get into singing? Because you're a classically trained singer, so how did that happen?
Yeah, that's a interesting journey. Well, I always sang. I guess my parents tell me that I used to squeal in my crib, and now that I have a son of my own, I'm seeing a lot of the same tendencies. He will just call to me from another room and really play and experiment with his voice as well. So, I was singing. I think I had my first debut at the age of 3 in our little country church. And then when I was 5, I won my first country western jamboree. And it just evolved from there. There's actually a large culture of choral singing that goes along with a lot of the Protestant, Norwegian Protestants that immigrated here. And that tradition, that rich tradition of choral singing has been kept up in the communities. So all of our schools and a lot of churches and in the communities still really celebrate choral singing. And so throughout my adolescence and into my teen years, I was competing and really able to explore some opportunities with that.
Now, you also went to Berklee Music School. I have a lot of friends that went there. They weren't lefties before they went there. They came out with just leftist programming. The Dakotas, I don't think there's a lot of lefties there. So how was that transition when you left the Dakotas and went to Berklee Music School?
It was horrible. I got really lost. I was so there. I think it's worth mentioning, there's a rootedness here. People are still connected to the land, and there's a respect for Mother Nature. There's a respect for the cycles and the seasons. People understand that, it's what you grow, you also eat, and it's a very organic connection still. And when I moved to the cities, I was shocked at this disconnection, and I struggled incredibly. I also struggled with the diversity, and I was the only student from the state of North Dakota struggling for a scholarship, but unable, in spite of a 4.0.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, you're incredibly talented, but your European roots, you're not diverse enough for that scholarship, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was an incredibly diverse school. That was their agenda. I believe at the time that was when Bush was invading Iraq, and I got swept up in that and was very. I remember protesting and marching in the streets of Mass Ave in Boston, and wow, that feels like another lifetime ago. But that was the start of my Marxist indoctrination in our university systems, for
So
sure.
it got to you basically. You went there at a younger age and it seeped in there by the time you graduated.
Well, I fortunately didn't graduate from there. I spent 2 years there, and my very logical down-to-earth parents said, listen, child, we'll give you 2 years, but we're not going to let you get $180,000 into debt with a music degree.
Yeah, I mean, is it really worth it? Because, I mean, like I said, I knew some musicians. I used to play in bands and sing and stuff. They were some amazing musicians. They went to school there. They came out, and it was like they became just formulaic musicians. They lost something that was special and unique before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the study of music can strip an artist of the reason and the essence of why they create, if that makes sense. You know, it starts becoming like, yes, very formulaic and less a part of the soul, unfortunately. After 2 years, I was very much so caught up in the liberal agenda and trying to date a mixed race gentleman who happened to lie to me about his entire identity and was an illegal alien.
Oh no!
It was just like this incredibly, you know, innocent and ignorant country girl gets. Wow.
The nice Scandinavian girl. Yep.
Yeah.
Jeez. So then I know in 2008, you went to Heidelberg, Germany, correct? And that's where you started your classical career as a soprano, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. That was really a wonderful opportunity. I started in the Staatliche Theater in Heidelberg as a soprano in the chorus, in the opera chorus. And I was also teaching on the military base when I started out because I couldn't speak German. And as my career progressed in the opera, it became apparent I must speak this language. And so I thought, you know, what better way to learn a culture and a people and about those people and their language than by being able to speak their language. So I really took it to heart, and it, you know, I had incentive, you know, I needed to eat. I needed to work. It's funny what you'll learn.
Yeah, exactly.
The incentive. So, I remember in one of the rehearsals, our director giving, you know, conducting the chorus and the orchestra, and I sang completely wrong in the wrong place.
Oh no.
And it was so humiliating.
Yeah, that is embarrassing.
And the Germans are so unforgiving.
Oh no.
That I thought, my God, I have got to learn this language. So I went head first, headlong into that. And I just decided that's what I was going to do. And within about, also with the goal of wanting to get my master's in opera while I was there, and in order to obtain entry into their graduate programs, obviously you had to be a German speaker. So the criteria for wanting work, wanting to study, wanting to be considered for, you know, possibly any, and just wanting to be considered as a serious person, the Germans took a lot of pride in, interestingly enough, a lot of pride in their language. So that's what I did. I learned German, and it opened up quite a few doors for me initially. I was able to move off of the military bases, which also was another completely new experience for me. I had no idea what type of presence the U.S. still had.
Wait, you were on a military base?
I was teaching music.
Ah, okay. I see.
Yeah, before I could speak German, I got work in addition to singing in the opera, teaching music on the military base. And there was about 3 or 4 just in the vicinity of Heidelberg itself. So there was this incredibly strong American presence.
Which is weird, isn't it? Like, why are all these military bases just occupying Germany still to this day?
Absolutely. Yes. And that was really, I believe, the beginning of my starting to ask those types of questions.
Now, when you were there, did you see lots of immigrants? Yeah, tell us about this process of how you started waking up to what was going on in Germany and Marxism and multiculturalism. How did it happen for you?
Sure. Well, initially, it was a slow indoctrination. In 2008, we'd had that crash in the States. I had been farming with my brother and my father and made a nice little profit. And then we had that economic crash. At that time, I was flying overseas to start this new adventure. And at the time, Heidelberg is also a cultural hub. It's the University of Heidelberg is Ivy League. It is one of the oldest libraries in Europe. There's an incredible amount of academia, and the Cancer Research Center is there. The Max Planck Institute is there. It's teeming with intellectuals. So, coming from a farming community, that was also very,
Intimidating.
I was very, I found it very interesting. And in 2008, it was more the Americans that were the main dominating presence there. As time went on, there became more and more talk of closing the bases, and I was involved in the theater and doing a lot of work off base, so I had already integrated relatively quickly into the German culture because of my desire to speak their language and my work in the theater. Well, as time went on, I know the Bürgermeister, I can't remember who was the mayor at the time, started sending out these plans of what they would eventually want to do with the space that the Americans were taking up in these bases if they closed. And I thought, okay, how interesting. Well, of course, it's a university town, so we could always, use more housing for students and for young artists, etc. And within a relatively short amount of time, I'd say from 2011 until 2015, they managed to close all of the bases, export all of the Americans, and all of a sudden, there was an incredible amount of housing available. At the same time that this refugee crisis.
Oh, what a coincidence, huh?
Exactly. And I almost couldn't believe what was happening before my eyes. I went from singing in Heidelberg, in Mannheim, and also then touring and performing with my own ensemble in France and in Switzerland and Austria, and with a performing lifestyle, you work nights, and never ever did I fear for my safety, being a blonde, blue-eyed, Scandinavian woman. And slowly but surely, as this transition was made. In the last 2 years, I'd say that I was there, I started to see a significant, a marked increase in, peoples of Northern African descent and a lot more women wearing burkas
And
and
hijabs. Yeah, a lot of people said it
hijabs.
felt like it was overnight, like someone just opened the doors and all of a sudden there's all these people everywhere, all these
It was.
non-Europeans everywhere.
Yep, it really literally was. And I also did martial arts with a pretty serious group of guys who were like my brothers. And it was so strange that I started noticing these things, and I really found that it was only in small circles that one was able to discuss these dynamics. Mm-hmm. And in my martial arts circle was one of them. I was able to, and they encouraged it and said, you be careful and you learn how to defend yourself because this isn't going away. And the news isn't covering it. We don't know why, but there had been an increase in violence with Turkish mobs, yes, of men attacking Germans, and that had already been quite a hot item, political item, with all of the Turks that had come into Germany and were unwilling to learn their language and still wanting to drain from their social system. And then what did they do? They opened the floodgates, and all of a sudden I was being stalked on the Straßenbahn, on the streetcar, and had to run into a pizzeria to tell the locals, please, this man is following me. I'm frightened for my safety.
Yeah, and now most of the pizzerias, at least in Sweden, are owned by immigrants too. Pizzerias and kebab shops everywhere. Yeah, right. That's awful.
Yeah, and it's been an ongoing conversation with friends of mine that are still there, especially women who, you know, we didn't think twice about riding our bikes home at night. You know, none of us had a car. It's Europe. I mean, it's this great, all these cities were built before the automobile. So we were all riding our bikes or taking walks and 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, one of my girlfriends, who is actually from South Africa, just went back to South Africa because she said she feels safer there.
Oh, no. That's amazing. I mean, well,
one of the top 10 most dangerous countries in the world, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
As she said, you know, when you're walking through the airport and there's a drunken Arab screaming in Arabic at the top of his lungs and you don't know what he's saying, you don't feel very safe.
And it's just funny how they try and tell Germans, who are, you know, such high culture in Germany, and they're just such innovative people who have brought us so many things. And then they say, oh, well, they need cultural enrichment from these Africans and Muslims. I mean, it's just outrageous. It's audacious, you know. Well, I mean, yeah, you were traveling in the circles, you know, classical music scene tends to be, you know, some of the elites, some of the upper class. Now, mm-hmm, I have friends that are also professional musicians, a friend who's probably listening and professional violinist, and she always talks about how it's just tons of lefties now in the classical music scene. Maybe it's always been that way. And some of these things she tries to talk to, and she's pretty much all on her own when she tries to bring up some of these conversations.
Oh.
Now, what did you find amongst the elite in Germany, and were they talking or noticing any of these things? I don't know how a lot of these upper class elites can feel good about seeing all these third worlders in their town, you know?
You know, that's a really interesting question to bring up. There's a couple of different sides to that. In and of itself, I became disillusioned with the music industry. I just decided that that wasn't necessarily what I thought it was going to be. And I think for good measure, I loved the time I spent in classical music, but I noticed that the productions were becoming more and more graphic. I noticed that the theater was using more and more nudity and vulgarity. I noticed that the staging was similar from Frankfurt to Heidelberg to Berlin, and I just could not get on board with nudity on stage. I don't care what the rhetoric is.
Sounds,
you know,
kind of more like a Weimar Republic. I don't know if you've looked into what was going on then. It was just total degenerate art. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, like Berlin was the hodgepodge in the 30s, and And I said to myself, okay, if that's the price I need to pay to go on stage and to be a leading act, then that isn't worth it. That isn't worth it. I'm worth more than that. A lot of the other experiences I had were younger singers being exploited by producers or, you know, hey, just whatever they could get away with. And, you know, so after I put my foot down and I said I won't be performing with, you know, under these and these circumstances, then I kind of found myself out of work.
Yeah.
A little bit. And that's actually what led me into the other direction of the healing arts and integrative medicine. Because I just was unwilling to,
Yeah, it's frightening when you realize that the arts is just completely infiltrated and run by Marxists. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
And we have to create our own arts. And that's why I'm happy to see that amongst the alt-right, meeting all kinds of talented people such as yourself, which is good because we need a cultural, our own kind of resurgence of culture and high culture again. The other thing I hear from friends that perform in the orchestra is that they're saying, white people aren't attending as much anymore to the symphony and the orchestra, and Asians are starting to attend, and Asians are even starting to play in the orchestras. I don't know if you've had any experience with
that. Oh, yes. It was a huge problem in the chorus. Most of our chorus was Korean. And I'm not sure if, well, this... part of the bone structure of a singer's face makes up for what they call the mask, and the resonance and the vibrations of the mask of the sinus cavities and of your different facial bones create a different brighter. You can have a brighter mask. You have a darker mask. You know, depending on your technique, and a typical Korean. This is going to be so politically incorrect.
They have stumpy little noses and flatter faces.
Well, they have a larger head, and there's more room for resonance there, but it isn't necessarily that just because a person can make a big sound doesn't mean it's more beautiful.
Yeah.
And so one of the problems we were running into in the chorus is that we had these giant voices that were they were unable, or they weren't used to the refining their sound to fit in with everyone else. It was like everybody was trying to be a solo act in a chorus, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. And what language would they be singing in? Was it in English or German, the Koreans?
Well, whatever, you know, whatever work that we were performing at the time, if it was Verdi or Puccini or, you know, Italian or German, just depended on the work that we were doing. And that normally wasn't an issue, but it was an issue in the music schools because most German Musikhochschule only has so many places available based upon how many opera houses there are, which makes sense. There's 200 opera houses in Germany in comparison to what, I don't know, maybe 20 some in the US.
Yeah.
So they have their universities. At least there's a little bit of logic in that regard. You know, here we just encourage kids to go and throw thousands of dollars into an education where they are not guaranteed a job. And there it was dependent upon the open seats or spots in the opera houses, and most of them were being filled by Asians.
Oh, that's just so sad. So
yeah.
Sad. And then, you know, if you go to San Francisco and you go to the symphony, there's plenty of Asians performing. I'm like, how is that not cultural appropriation? People are trying to deny that classical music is from Europeans now.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up about the resonance and the face and singing and bone structure. That must be why I heard Barbara Streisand, because she has a fairly large nose. That's why she never wanted to get a nose job, because it would completely change the sound, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, people will talk about that all the time. And in pop music, one of the reasons why there has to be such a high turnover rate is because the incredible amount of pressure and strain that's put not only on the vocal cords, but on the schedules of the singers. I mean, from Adele to Keith Urban to, I mean, the list goes on and on of those who have had to have surgery because there's just,
it's just not natural. You're not supposed to be performing that much.
You know? Right. Exactly. They're expendable.
So, and also you've done more of a modern song we're going to play later. Gotta Clear My Head. We'll end the show with that. So tell us about that music that you're doing now that's up on SoundCloud.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I guess I was always a little bit torn between this classical world and my American country ranching and cowboy upbringing. This connection to the land has been such a gift. It's given me the ability to stay grounded and to stay rooted in spite of all of that. The media can be so charming. They can be so persuasive with their messages. Even when I went to Berkeley, I remember watching music videos for the first time, and thinking.
You didn't miss much.
Right, and thinking that's how women acted. Thinking that that was the norm and that I didn't have any idea how to act around men. And it is so incredible that I was able to find my way back. And I give credit to my rootedness and growing up on a farm and a ranch, working with my hands, working with my family alongside my family and riding horse and rounding up cattle and
fun.
Yeah.
I can ride too. I used to do dressage and jumping, but I can't go after cattle. I can't rope any cattle. You could probably rope cattle, right?
Yeah, I'm not the best roper, but my husband is pretty handy with a rope. And, that's actually my first memory of him. We grew up not too terribly far apart from one another, but he went to a different school. And I knew of him, but never really knew him. And my first memory is maybe when I was 12 or 14 at a local neighbor's cattle branding. And we were all rounding up their herd on the refuge. And I remember this pretty cute, shy guy on a horse. And they were, that was, gosh, I don't want to date myself exactly, but that was a while ago, and to this day, he's still got that very calm, gentle hand with a horse and our dogs and now our son.
Yeah, being outside, being in nature is so important. I spend way too much time in front of the computer. I think a lot of us do in this modern day kind of lifestyle now.
Yeah.
And the alt-right taking part in propaganda wars and everyone's making videos. We're inside so much, but it is good to get outside and maybe grow some food. It's very healing. I think that's the one thing that always sets me right when I feel down from everything else. Just go outside and you always feel better in nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads me directly into the songwriting. I think the poetry of the West and the history of American composers, Aaron Copland, for instance, the American folk song is something that is slowly dying. And I was fortunate to have a wonderful mentor in my youth in music that encouraged my my songwriting and my writing in general, and also really, really loved the American folk song. So I grew up singing in doing some competitions in American folk songs, strictly in that category, learning the history and learning the heritage. And so it was like a natural progression for me to write. And on the prairies in the Dakotas especially, the winters are so isolating and they're so brutal. You have to figure out what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. It's dark by 4. It's usually 30 below. And, you know, the wind is blowing most of the time. So what a lot of families do is make music.
Yeah, because they're inside, they have to entertain each other. And in the old days, they didn't have electricity. That they did. They told stories. They sang. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it was always kind of my quest to figure out or to find my niche. You know, I had a lot of people say, well, you need to decide between classical, you need to decide between country, or you need to decide between folk. And I had such a difficult time with that because they were all a part of me. I mean, historically speaking, obviously I was drawn to classical music. That's a part of my ancestral heritage.
Yeah.
You know, and then even more recently, the folk singing and the storytelling, really, which is what American folk and country Western music is, and it is rooted in, is also a part of my ancestry. So it evolved into a sort of journey that brought me to Europe, and that brought me to continue composing and to continue not being satisfied with the cultural norm. I was never comfortable in that expendable, you know, pop entertainment.
Yeah, it's
industry.
Awful. I've always just hated it ever since I was a young girl. I never liked the pop music, the hip hop music. It's all just trashy. Ugh, I don't like any of it.
And I really tried. I really tried, but I found myself so alienated and so alone and so I'm having a hard time finding, you know, a way to really put it into words. It didn't fit. And I tried to fit myself into that mold, and I was incredibly unhappy.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah. So fortunately, I think that was some kind of inner compass, an inner guide that just said, listen, you don't need to be that person.
Yeah, I went through that actually in my early 20s. I was in L.A. and I always liked, you know, more alternative music or electronica. My brother's a producer, mixer, engineer, so we did a lot of projects together. And when I was living in L.A., I knew a lot of people that were A&R people for a lot of the major labels. Like, they were my friends. We hung out. And they always tried to get me to do projects and sing, and I did a couple, and then they'd say, oh, you know, you have to change your hair, or you need to wear this, or you need to sound like this, or sing like that. It was miserable. I hated it. Just walked away from all that. So I know exactly what you're talking about. It's awful.
Yeah, that's really nice to have that reciprocated and hear that to be acknowledged, because I also was on The Voice of Germany before I left Germany. And I did the, you know, I did the live audition, and just the amount of the expected degeneracy.
Yeah.
you know, was shocking. Overall, I have to say I'm grateful for the experience, because it really was part of my awakening in realizing that's not for me. And I am too honest to be in that business.
One thing when it comes to music, I have to say, I think Europeans, we're the most diverse. I mean, think of all the different styles that we've created. Whereas when you go to Asia or Africa or the Middle East, it's the same sound, really. Or you go to India, it's the same kind of sound. You go to, you know, Europe and America, we've created so many different genres, haven't we?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that was really part of my starting to feel like I was a part of something bigger, was when I learned my German, my native German language, and got to know the thinking. Because when you speak a different language, you think differently, you relate differently. And we've become so far removed from our roots, from our rootedness, from our ancestors, from understanding that we're part of a line. We're part of a struggle. We're part of a lot of sacrifice that all of our forefathers and those that came before us endured in ways that we can't imagine. You know, I still, when this last winter in North Dakota was incredibly hard. We had more snowstorms, more snowfall, and more frigid temperatures than I think in the last 20 years. And I think to myself, look at all of the amenities we have, the internet, the connection, the radio programs, you know, the internet connection. The pioneers had none of that. And when they left on a ship, they maybe got a letter. Maybe they had a chest from home and they survived. And I think, how important is it for us to remember the type of strength in that lineage?
That is right. They were tough people. And we have to remember, too, that many of the settlers that came to America, it was upwards of half died trying to settle this land. Half. So there was no white privilege. No one just gave them anything. They had to do everything from scratch, created everything from scratch, or they would die. No one helped them.
Right. Absolutely. I cannot imagine getting through a winter in under those circumstances and having to build shelter and find water and food. And that has been also a big part of my just rejection of the left, because nobody gave our ancestors, and my ancestors in particular, any handouts. They fought and struggled and prevailed. And I think that we have a right to be proud of that and be proud of that history.
It's interesting, too. It makes sense now why we know that socialism arose in the Nordic countries, because it really stems from an old survival thing, helping each other survive those long, harsh winters. And everyone had the same kind of work ethic. They thought the same way. They had the same mentality. So it actually worked.
Exactly. Absolutely. I still, you know, since moving back home to the States from Germany, I'm still getting used to that that jovial spirit, that willingness to help. You know, if somebody is broke down on the highway, people will still stop here and ask if they can help. Or, you know, I was snowed in and I called my neighbor and he came over with his tractor to blow out my driveway. And then I baked a banana bread and brought it over for coffee. And,
oh, that's sweet.
That's just still really a part of the culture here. And unfortunately, because of the influx of, not influx, the overtake of the German country by foreigners, people are too afraid to look you in the eye. And
I noticed that when I was there too. It's actually several European countries recently where it's people don't even interact with each other anymore. That's what multiculturalism does. It people cut off because things become sketchy. People don't interact the same way anymore. Yeah, it's sad to see that happen.
It is. And it's very isolating. And interestingly enough, what I find so, it makes me laugh. People segregate naturally. And in Heidelberg, there were sections that were Turkish. There were sections and enclaves that were Russian. There were sections that were Persian. And there was nothing wrong with that. Nobody had a problem with that. It's how people naturally want to gravitate towards their own.
That's right.
But if that would be reported or even just touched upon in any kind of a positive manner, I've just had to learn to take everything with a grain of salt, because that kind of natural segregation is blown out of proportion. And, you know, after moving back home to the Dakotas, where we have a strong native population, and I moved back for a teaching position on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation to a school that's segregated in 1975. It was 100% Native.
Yeah, they're allowed to have that, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And I was floored because the story surrounding it is just as interesting. The majority of the Native community didn't want the segregation. There was a few families that were for it when AIM, the American Indian Movement, came in, trying to convince them that they needed to be liberated and have their own in their own school. The farming communities and the primarily Northern European farmers in that area all had gone to that school prior to 1975. It was a very successful community. And once that decision was made, the natives, the elders, still talked and said, we fought and told them this will set us back 100 years.
Interesting. So they wanted to be blended to be in with everyone else. Huh? Oh, mm-hmm. Interesting. Because usually most of the Indians that I've encountered, you know, growing up in Oregon, there's lots of Indian reservations. They're kind of hostile towards white people. You know, they don't like them around. Yeah. They don't want to live with them. So, you know, sounds like they're different up there.
Well, the Arikara tribe was one of the most generous and gracious tribes. It's pretty well documented in that the Saanich Nation or the Arikara Nation was a very gentle and gracious, hospitable tribe. They ended up having to band together with the Mandan and Hidatsa because they were being hunted and slaughtered so mercilessly by the Sioux.
That's just it. These Indians were slaughtering each other long before we showed up.
Right. That they were close to the brink of extinction before General Custer and the American cavalry came in. So, yeah, there is that narrative. Now, with this Dakota Access Pipeline, things have been completely blown out of proportion.
Yeah, I don't know much about that. What can you tell us about it?
It makes me incredibly angry and sad. And I have to say, the year that I spent teaching on the reservation was eye-opening and heartbreaking all in one. I had no idea what was going on in my own backyard, so to speak. I mean, the reservation is, what, an hour and a half, 2 hours away from where I grew up. The alcoholism, the abuse, the neglect, the drug addiction, the utter wastefulness. I was shocked. I absolutely adored the children, but those children were being raised by children. The addiction is so rampant and the sexual abuse is so high, it's crippling. I just
and you know, and white people get blamed for that a lot of the time, you know.
You know, and I just, yeah, I didn't understand when I went in. I was really looked on with a lot of suspicion. But for me, you know, I was still living in my little liberal leftist bubble, thinking that I, you know, was just colorless, you know, and that they were just going to love me for who I was. And it was a harsh reality. I did love those kids and tried to just be there for them because they didn't have any adults that were positive role models. They didn't have anybody that wasn't drunk and that wasn't not only on drinking alcohol, but also using. And so I had not only a lot of fetal alcohol children, but a lot of children that had been born while their parents were taking meth.
What do you think is the root cause for all of this? You know, because a lot of times people want to blame the white people that came over, but we know the history of America is much more complex over who was here first. I mean, we can debate that for a long time. But why didn't the Indians open their arms to multiculturalism, right? A lot of white people say that it was wrong back then for whites to migrate over here. But then today, when the same thing's being done to us, all of a sudden, it's okay. But what do you think is the root cause of what's affecting a lot of Indians with their addiction and abuse? Where does it stem from?
Look, any in the history of the world, you know, in Rome, in any civilization that has been invaded, normally those people, A, aren't allowed to live.
Yeah.
Or they assimilate. It's never been the case that a major civilization has gone in and conquered and just said, hey, you're going to be able to live the way you were able to before. Never in the history of the world has that been the case.
History is full of stories of conquest and invasion. Yes.
Right. And I believe that is a natural, that is a natural part of man. We have tried to separate ourselves from that, but we just have ongoing a virtual warfare that's excruciating and nothing ever really gets completed. In this instance, these people carry incredible generational scars. Unfortunately, they've been made... They've been enabled by our federal government to continue this dialect of victimhood. And this dialect of victimhood has done nothing but breed helplessness, breed blaming, and breed a sense of not wanting to take responsibility.
Yes, it's basically they get a basic guaranteed income. I know a lot of Indians get that from the government, and it's actually been a downfall in a lot of ways, this welfare. Absolutely. I mean, it's the same thing as we've seen in the Black community. It's the exact same thing. So it's interesting, though, that we get called all these names when usually in the past people invaded exactly. They would just full-on genocide or destroy people that didn't assimilate. And here we are, we're giving them money and trying to prop them up and give them land, and it's still not working.
Right. It's a modern day experiment in socialism that has failed.
Yeah.
That has failed so miserably that these people's children's children are still unable to function outside of the reservation and inside the reservation. Anybody that does become successful is usually beaten up or robbed or, they want to tear them down, or they just simply have to leave.
Yep. And this is a good lesson of why multiculturalism fails, right? We all try to live together. We all try to make everyone live in the same way, and it's failed. This is what happens when, I mean, the Indians have lost touch with their roots. They don't even know how to do things that their ancestors used to do. They probably don't even know some of the stories anymore. We kind of have these mythical ideas. You know, a lot of white people will go to these Indian reservations and smoke peyote and try and go for this, finding enlightenment and stuff. But it isn't that romantic on most Indian reservations today, unfortunately.
Once you get a good look at all of the trash and the garbage and the holes in car windows and I remember a few of the newer houses that had been put up on a regular basis. There's some new houses that are brought onto the reservation, and one of them had a hole cut in the wall with the bathtub filled up so the horse could stick his head in to have a drink.
Oh, jeez.
There you go.
Oh, God.
We're making do.
The other thing that I find sad is it's a lot of the Indians or even Mexicans that come. It doesn't matter where they come from. They always gravitate to rap music, too. Like that African rap, yeah. Hip-hop music. It's just, mm-hmm. What is that?
Very much so. I think it's grasping for some type of acceptance, some type of identity. Everybody wants to feel a part of something, right? Everybody wants to feel a part of a group. And that's one of the downfalls, unfortunately, of this multicultural agenda. People are rootless. They aren't associating with their group or with growing up with any knowledge of their ancestral lines. So, you know, well, which group looks most like me? Well, I guess that group does. So I'm going to try and listen to their music. Yeah, that's what I should do because that's hip.
I mean, it's kind of something tribal about it. They're looking for some kind of tribe, and it's very base level. Hip hop music is very simple. It works on kind of the lower chakra, if you will. You know, it's really basic.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there's a lot of, there are quite a few powwows, and powwow music is really celebrated, and I, you know, go for it. Everybody that can celebrate their own tribe and in a way that is, you know, individual and specific to them, I am all for that. Unfortunately, a lot of the times what happens at powwows is people end up just throwing all their trash and garbage on the ground, and for it being in order, it doesn't coincide with that whole, this is sacred, holy ground. When everybody's throwing all their garbage and trash.
Yeah. Jeez. No,
go ahead.
Are you guys getting an influx of refugees in the Dakotas? Because I'm hearing reports from Idaho and a lot of those other, you know, pockets that are very white and rural, that they're getting refugees.
Yes. Yes. And we're being targeted in unprecedented ways. In the last 2 to 5 years, I would say the Lutheran Social Services has done its absolute best to import Somalians and North Africans into the Dakotas. And it's, as far as I know, Fargo, which is our largest city, the crime rate went up 25%. Jeez. In 1 year. And now going into Walmart, last time I checked was one of two white people.
Oh, jeez.
And I thought to myself, you've got to be kidding. And I have married a man of Scandinavian heritage, and we now have a son, and we're all fair and have blue eyes, and every single person cannot leave that baby alone. And he comments on his eyes and how beautiful, and oh my goodness. And I think to myself, okay, thank you, first of all, you know, thanks. Yes, I love my son and I think he's beautiful too. But everybody wants to talk about there not being a preference and we're all colorblind and this and that. And there it not being any type of preferred beauty.
Yeah, ideal beauties, yeah.
And it's just blatantly not the case.
It's interesting, too, how you travel. I'm well-traveled. I know you are, too. You go to other countries where, you know, the majority of the world is not white. Majority of the world has brown eyes. So mm-hmm. for that sake, you know, Europeans are unique because of what we have. We're rare because you don't find blonde and blue all around the world. That's why I think it's coveted and people are so fascinated by it because it's rare. It's special. Mm-hmm. And then here we are, you know, we're getting hit with this anti-white propaganda that white is boring, blonde is boring, we need to be spicy, we need to mix it out, right? And it's like, there's people across the world who covet blonde and blue. They would love to have that. And then
absolutely.
And then our own people who are that are hating themselves and wanting to lose that and blend in just to look like everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I even had students on the reservation who were using blue contacts and wanting blue eyes. And I myself personally didn't ever understand why I had such feelings of, you know, self-loathing, not understanding why, even though I knew that I was an attractive female, I felt bad that I was attractive, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? And I did. I would do my hair and my makeup. And innerly, I had a very difficult time accepting my own beauty because I felt like I was somehow, and I didn't understand why. You know, this went on throughout my teens and my 20s. Why I felt ashamed that I was white, Northern European, female, and attractive.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marxism, I think, it really is a war on beauty. They've targeted groups that are beautiful, that are intelligent, that are capable, and trying to guilt them, you know, to feel bad for being and having what they have, so that they want to surrender to this blob, this melting pot, you know, and just give everything away. It's awful.
Absolutely. And I, unfortunately, you know, the mentor that I talked about that helped foster so much of my musical development was unfortunately an incredible liberal feminist, and was so derogatory and demeaning to my development as a proud and healthy young woman. I struggled incredibly in my 20s and almost lost to the cultural Marxist war and agenda. I really tried to do everything I could to, you know, to fit in and to be more spicy and to, you know, tan my skin darker and to listen to more diversified music and you know, really swallowed that whole rhetoric that I had never had the opportunities that men had, and I was being discriminated against. I really believed that for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't until I met my husband and we, gosh, are of the same background and had the same struggles and really started opening my eyes to, wow, I've never been happier with somebody that's like me.
Exactly.
And it's okay to be around and to celebrate my ethnic heritage, to want to continue my family line. I always wanted children that looked like me. I didn't ever understand that. But I used to say, you know, yeah, I'd really love blonde-haired, blue-eyed babies.
Of course.
And I'd kind of have to say it under my breath because I felt bad. It was, you know, come on. It's in all of our education system is just riddled with this rhetoric.
Yeah, and that is proof right there of an anti-white agenda when they're literally trying to make white women such as yourself guilty for wanting to procreate and duplicate yourself.
Exactly, you know, and I look at how close I came to it almost working, and I see myself as a success story. Absolutely. And I have never been happier or felt more fulfilled, more grounded and rooted as I do now with my heterosexual white husband.
Yeah, exactly. And you
Now
guys
my
came
unhappy
from
lover.
same blood, you know, I mean, it ties you together. It feels like family when you come from the same tribe, if you will, the same people, the same
Yeah.
lineage, the same land. It's powerful. It's going to ground you too for the rest of your life. You won't be divorced.
Absolutely. And, you know, going on then and starting our family and having our first child and seeing every ethnic background praise and just swoon over the characteristics of our son. I think, what a joke. What a joke. They just keep trying to tell everyone it doesn't matter. That's not beautiful. Every single, I don't care if it's been Hispanic, Black, Mulatto, Indian, Native American, everyone has said we have never seen such intensity and such beautiful blue eyes as we have in your child. And I think, you know what? That's right. We did that on purpose.
Yeah, that's great. Wonderful. You got to say though, maybe you got to stop shopping at Walmart. I can't some more support the that corporation. I think they're pretty anti. You got to order online. I think there's a lot of good mom and pop shops too.
Yeah, that's so true. Amazon Prime has been great, but unfortunately, sometimes we've just had to bite the bullet and go in there.
Yeah, when because you're so isolated, there isn't much up there.
Yeah, yes.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's been a harsh reality.
Last question for you. I'm curious, how did you stumble upon the alt-right and people like us, Red Ice?
You know, I really came across it through my husband when we were first starting to date and get acquainted. You know, he had some ideas that were really unbelievable to me, and I'm a hard one anyway, but in the sense that I have to ask questions. And I thought to myself, look, Nicole, if you're going to ask and be so critical of him, then you better be willing to listen to what he has to say. And because of his life experiences and him being so well traveled and also having the same background as me, he started introducing me to some of his ideologies. And, you know, we really were gridlocked for a while. I wasn't quite sure if we were going to make it. But in the you know, in this discovery of what he was presenting to me, I started noticing some similarities. And, you know, back to further or into our earlier in our conversation, when you were asking me about how the elites in Germany were, if this was ever coming up in conversations in those circles, yes, it was. In one of my very dear friends in the integrative medical clinic that I worked at, a medical doctor had who's actually the descendant of a figure in German history, Karl Dönitz, the general or admiral of the naval department of the Third Reich. He had sort of introduced me to some of these ideas, and I thought he was the most racist bastard. I hated him for it. We were the closest of friends, but he could never bring up a single thing. And then I found out that actually his family name was a part of German history, and I was so suspicious of him. I thought, you Nazi.
Yeah.
And, you know, here he was actually opening the door for an entire new, a brave new world. There we go. And it wasn't until, you know, fast forward 4 or 5 years later that I met my husband to be that these same types of ideas kept coming up. And I was so disenchanted by the, you know, I think the television and entertainment industry in and of itself had, you know, kind of just chewed me up and spit me out. And I was left reeling, wondering, you know, what, how to make sense of this world, how to deal with these feelings and sense of alienation and not being able to connect with most people around me, and being fortunate enough to find my spouse and him having dealt with that as well. And then diving into some deep philosophy, Kant, Nietzsche, a lot of very hard questions, you know, because I speak, I'm fluent in German, and I started actually reading Karl Marx. I started really reading what was said. And I just slowly but surely also realized what had happened to me in Germany. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, I was a well-educated, fluent speaking, single woman with work experience, and the Germans kicked me out.
Unbelievable.
I mean, I'm a, you know, and it wasn't just me. It was, I had a work contract that was open-ended. My professor and boss at the medical clinic that I was working at endorsed me and wrote 3 different letters to the foreigner's office begging them for me to stay.
It didn't work?
It worked to a point. And I was able to stay for 2 more years. And after that worker's visa was up, and I was unemployed, I said, okay, you know what? Because I'm an honest person, I'll go on unemployment. I was offered 8 months of unemployment after having worked 2.5 years and contributing to the system. I said, okay, you know what? I'm okay with that. So I gave myself 8 months. And I said, at the end of that, if I haven't found, you know, another steady position, I'm going to head home.
It's a good thing that happened, because then you were able to go home and get married and have a kid.
Exactly, right. And it was just about that time that influx of refugees took over the country. And I just said, geez, what more does this country want? I mean, a person of Northern European and specifically German heritage.
No, they don't want those.
Educated.
Yeah, Marxists
that learned
don't want
their
you there.
Language. What else do they want? And it wasn't until another one of my girlfriends who worked with me at the medical clinic, multiple degrees, fluent in German. Actually, she was born from South Africa, grew up speaking German at home, and her visa wasn't renewed as well. She
it's
was
outrageous. Meanwhile, these Africans just scale the walls and come right in and get free everything. It's unbelievable.
And most of the Germans couldn't understand why I was so angry. That was the real turning point, where I was just watching this all unfold before my eyes, and I wasn't being offered any type of work that I could live and have a sustainable, any type of enjoyable life from. I just had to look at the quality of life, and I was like, that's it.
Jeez.
I'm done trying to fight for a space here. You know, if that's the type of people that they want there, then go for it. And unfortunately, I've just had to kind of extend the invitation to friends and my martial arts colleagues. I've said, hey guys, when it gets too bad, we've got a spot for you here in North Dakota.
Yeah, well, we might drop by there and visit. I know a lot of people are kind of eyeing it up there and around those parts. So you never know, it might drop by. Well, Nicole, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your story. I always love hearing how people come to the alt-right, how they find us, how they wake up. And thanks to that German fellow who planted seeds, I think it's important to always remember to drop little seeds in everybody that we meet, because eventually they do bloom, and you had bloomed later and you recognize some of those things when your husband said them. So it's important to be doing that. And for the listeners, why don't you give out your website and let people know how they can find your music? I'm going to end the show with a song called Gotta Clear My Head by you.
Sure. My website is just njorgensen.wixsite.com, and then it's /Nicole-Jorgensen.
All right.
It's kind of a long one.
It's okay. We'll share the link anyway. But thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Every day I receive moving messages from people sharing their story of how they found Red Ice and the alt-right. Even from housewives in North Dakota who grasp the current reality better than anyone on mainstream media. We are a rapidly growing demographic, and no amount of anti-white propaganda is going to stop it. We may not get that border wall, but in our hearts and minds, it exists, protecting what we hold dear, our ancestry, our heritage, and our people. A special thanks to all our members who make this show possible. We need your support. If you appreciate what we do, sign up for a Red Ice membership at redicemembers.com. We have different options available, or you can donate via paypal.me/redice. I'll be back next week with Philosophy Cat and a special Red Ice TV interview with a couple in Russia who will comment on the Rusphobia in America, claims of Putin hacking the election, the alt-right, and much more. We'll talk again soon.
Gotta clear my head, gotta clear my mind. Something's running all the time. Where it's gonna lead, I'm just trying to believe. See. A piece of mind.